representing Rulo has 16 minutes, and Mr. Reuter, representing the Village of Rockdale, has 9 minutes, according to my sheet. Is that right? I will announce that Justice Wilcox, who ordinarily sits to my left, is not participating in this case. You may proceed, Ms. Hancock.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Susan Hedman, appearing today on behalf of Rural, Responsible Use of Rural and Agricultural Land, a group of citizens who seek to protect the environment and preserve the unique character of the rapidly disappearing rural areas in eastern Dane County and western Jefferson County. My remarks this morning will focus on the Public Service Commission's and the Department of Natural Resources application of Section 96 of Act 204 in the Rockgen CPCN procedure. Alan Reuter, counsel for co-petitioner Village of Rockdale, will use the balance of our time to address issues related to Chapter 96 and DNR permitting rules.
Counsel, would you make sure to speak up? I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
Perhaps I should. Madam Chief Justice and members of the court, virtually everything you need to know to understand why the Rockgen Power Plant Project was not eligible for expedited environmental review under Section 96 of Act 204 is contained in this contract, the Rockgen Power Purchase Agreement.
Is that in your appendix?
It is not in our appendix because, unfortunately, Rockgen and Wisconsin Power and Light insist in keeping this document under seal. And there's a lot we can't say about it in open court, but there's a lot that we can. Indeed, if you are referring to the record, you can find it under document number 27, which is the Public Service Commission record in this case, and it is Exhibit 96 in that particular sheet of documents. There is enough in the open record to conclusively make the case that the Rockgen project does not qualify for expedited environmental review and should not be built without first conducting a comprehensive analysis pursuant to the Wisconsin Environmental Policy Act and Chapter 196 of the statutes to examine reasonable alternatives to the site in rural Christiana. The narrowly tailored language in Section 96 of Act 204 strictly limits eligibility for expedited environmental review of power plant projects, facilities under contract to supply new electric generating capacity to eastern Wisconsin utilities. As you well know, two of the three 175 megawatt turbines that make up the Rockgen project are not under contract with an eastern Wisconsin utility. In fact, the contract obligates these turbines to utilities that are not even located in Wisconsin. That fundamental, uncontested fact is sufficient by itself to render the Rockgen project ineligible for expedited environmental review under the unambiguous language of Section 96 of Act 204.
Well, if I understood the briefs of the opponents, they're saying they will and do supply power to the areas set forth in the statutes, but that they can supply power elsewhere too.
Wisconsin Power and Light's service territory is certainly one of the eastern Wisconsin utilities service territory. They have testified, however, in this case, that with respect to the one turbine at the Rockgen facility where they do have a contract, that they do not intend to actually use any electricity from this turbine to serve their customers. Indeed, they've testified that they would interrupt their interruptible customers before they would take electricity from this plant. Their briefs are replete with speculation about who might buy this power, but there is nothing at all in the administrative record in this case that indicates there is any contract by any Eastern Wisconsin utility to take electricity from the plant. And a contract with an Eastern Wisconsin utility is what Section 96 of Act 204 unambiguously requires.
Well, specifically, are you referring to sub B of...
Section 96 has essentially... Three elements. There needs to be a RFP that has been issued at the time that the statute became effective, or this non-statutory language became effective. And that RFP has to have been issued by an Eastern Wisconsin utility.
That's B.
That's B. Further, the utility has to enter into that contract with a successful bidder by a date certain specified in the statute or a date approved by the commission beyond the date specified in the statute. I would suggest that the contract for the single Rock Gen turbine that is subject to use by a potential use by an Eastern Wisconsin utility is a far cry from what the legislature had in mind when it adopted Section 96 of Act 204. As I said, WP&L testified in this case that it does not actually anticipate using any electricity under the terms of this contract to serve its Wisconsin customers, and admitted that it would shut off its interruptible customers before taking power. It's no wonder that the Public Service Commission specifically declined to make a finding of reasonableness when it reviewed Wisconsin Power and Light's contract.
Did it have to make a finding of reasonableness?
Well,
I know you say that in other contracts they have.
In the only other case that we can look at that's similar to the Rockgen case, we can see that in that particular case, the SEI case, which is the contract that Wisconsin Electric Power had with an independent power producer to procure electricity under Section 96, we can see that in that case, the Public Service Commission very clearly looked at the contract and made a finding of reasonableness as a step in its findings before approving that project. And it seems to me that it is inconceivable that the legislature could have intended that a contract that was not reasonable could have risen to a level that met a standard that would require expedited review. And I can point you to no clear authority that says exactly what is required, but I can tell you only that what the Public Service Commission did in this case is inconsistent with what it did elsewhere.
On the issue of reasonableness, I assume that you're referring to 196.491, and it states the proposed facility needs to satisfy the reasonable needs of the public for adequate supply of electric energy. It goes on to state in sub 2, this subdivision does not apply to a wholesale merchant plant. Is this a wholesale merchant plant?
This is a wholesale merchant plant, and no, that isn't the particular instance of reasonableness that I'm referring to. What I'm referring to is in the Public Service Commission's order point number 19, in which the Commission made what I would call almost an unfinding, and that is that the Commission makes no finding in this proceeding as to the reasonableness of the purchase power agreement executed between Alliant WPL and RockGen Energy.
But you don't have any authority that requires them to make a finding of reasonableness, and you would say that the statute that Justice Bradley read doesn't apply here. Is that right?
They don't cite that particular statute in this instance. The finding as to reasonableness may indeed refer to the section of the statute which Justice Bradley referred to. I could not say that conclusively.
Isn't this only an exception to that statute? What was the terminology? Merchant?
Wholesale merchant plant.
Wholesale merchant. Isn't that what this is?
This is a wholesale merchant plant. My understanding of the Commission's finding here goes to the reasonableness of this contract as it relates to the deal that Wisconsin Power and Light made for its ratepayers, not whether or not this is a contract that's reasonable in the sense of a merchant plant. And I believe in one of the briefs that has been filed by the Public Service Commission in this proceeding, they indeed made reference to that point, and at least one of the respondents indicated that they thought it quite likely that that matter would be resolved in subsequent rate cases.
Well, did the Public Service Commission, and I'm groping for its findings, which I have here somewhere and is in your appendix, did they make a finding that this is a contract between appropriate parties dealing with eastern Wisconsin?
They made a finding only that there was a contract between Alliant-WPNL and Rockton Energy, and that it was, they entered into the contract on August 10th, 1998. That's order point number two in the findings of fact.
But they didn't label it as a contract within a particular statute?
No. Okay. No, they did not.
Did they make a finding consistent with 196.491? The proposed facility will not unreasonably interfere with the orderly land use and development plans for an area involved.
They did make a finding regarding land use. I would ask the court's permission to defer that question to co-counsel who is dealing with the land use matters.
You're talking about
case.
Reasonableness, and that was one of the buzzwords I was thinking.
The Public Service Commission and the Department of Natural Resources clearly erred when they decided to use the accelerated 90-day procedure authorized in Section 96 to review RockGen's application. With two-thirds of the committed capacity under contract to entities that are not eastern Wisconsin utilities, and the remaining third under contract with an eastern Wisconsin utility that clearly states it does not intend to use power from this plant. The agency's erroneous decision to accelerate the environmental review of this project deprived the public of essential rights under the Wisconsin Environmental Policy Act in Chapter 196, including time to review and comment on a draft environmental impact statement. That is not, as respondents suggest, a harmless procedural error. Indeed, as this court pointed out over 20 years ago, in Wisconsin Environmental Decade versus the Public Service Commission, the procedural rights accorded citizens under the Wisconsin Environmental Policy Act have very real substantive consequences for the environment. And that is certainly true in this case, where the Public Service Commission and DNR opted to use a procedure that left no time to revise the EIS when, for instance, citizens pointed out that the EIS failed to consider the very site that WPNL originally identified for this project in its request for proposals soliciting bids for new capacity, a site already zoned to accommodate WPNL's Rock River power plant with right-of-way for gas lines and transmission lines already in place. I submit that had that site been considered in a revised EIS, the impacts of building there compared with the impacts of building on prime agricultural land in rural Christiana, that the outcome of that analysis and this case might well have been very different. But all of that was precluded when the Public Service Commission and DNR put the RockGen plant on a fast track for approval and issued only a final EIS.
Counsel, should you prevail, What do you want done? Now, we issued, if my memory is right, an order that refused to stay the construction, right? And said that should Alliant et al. Lose, then in accordance with their promise, they would pay all the costs, et cetera, that result from that. So what do you expect to happen if you should win?
Well, we would ask the court to reverse the Public Service Commission's order and remand, if the court sees fit, the matter for a full environmental review before the Public Service Commission. And it's certainly conceivable that the commission could decide that the RockGen site was the appropriate site. We think that would not be the case if indeed there was a review of the alternative sites, including, for instance, Rock River. In that case, the effect of this court's decision would ultimately be that the plant at that site would have to be torn down. And that would not be the first time this court has decided a case which resulted in a building, a project already or partially under construction, having to be torn down after the fact. I can provide citations of cases if that would be appropriate. I direct the court's attention particularly to State v. Trudeau, which is 139 Wisconsin 2nd 91, which involved a condominium on Madeline Island that was found to be below the ordinary high water mark of Lake Superior, and which was subsequently torn down and
how
never
complete
destroyed.
Is this plant?
I beg your pardon?
How complete is the plant now? When is the completion date?
Well, I had occasion to visit the site yesterday to answer that question for myself, and what I could see are a lot of footings and some transmission towers that were under construction and a lot of equipment on site. But my sense is that probably Mr. Garden could speak to that in more detail.
How big is this in perspective? I can't get a perspective because I'm just too unaware of, you know, the size of plants, et cetera. This is what, the proposal is 540
megawatts? 525
megawatts. How does that compare, for instance, to other plants around the state or around the country?
Well, there are a variety of...
Is it a big plant or is it, relatively speaking, a minor plant?
Well, in this case... There are currently power plants pending in Wisconsin that are much larger than this, plants that are nearly 1,000 megawatts pending over in the area near Pleasant Prairie. There are also smaller peak load facilities that, in fact, this project originally started out to be in the initial RFP. Indeed, the finding of need that the Public Service Commission made prior to this proceeding was that only 170 megawatts was needed, and that 170 megawatt freestanding combustion turbine would have been a much smaller plant, and indeed it was a plant that even Commissioner Farrow thought would have been appropriate to build on the site.
Thank you, Council. And you will have, I gather, 3 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Reuter, representing the Village of Rockdale.
May it please the court, my name is Alan Reuter, and I represent the Village of Rockdale, petitioner co-appellant in this case. This case illustrates the enormous power that an administrative agency can have to affect the lives and property of citizens of Wisconsin. The Public Service Commission is given the power to override the determinations of land use regulations made by elected local officials in the towns, the villages, cities, and the county. PSC has the power in an appropriate case to cite a 525-watt mega 525 megawatt power plant permanently in a rural farmland protection area. The decision makers at the PSC are not accountable to the public, as are the local officials. I raise that not to argue that there's a problem with the administrative process in general. There are good reasons to have administrative decisions. I raise it rather to highlight the importance of enforcing those restrictions on the agency's power that are written into the law. The key rule of accountability for agencies, the key restriction, the baseline restriction on their power, is the fact that they have only the power that is granted by the legislature. The legislature always retains the authority to determine what the PSC can do and what it cannot do. And one of the key issues in this case, from our standpoint, is a determination by the legislature as to exactly what the PSC may not do. In Section 196.491 sub 3E, the legislature determined that one of the things the PSC may not do is that the commission may not issue a certificate of public convenience and necessity until the department, meaning the DNR, has issued all of the required environmental permits. It's conceded by the parties to this case that as of December 18, 1998, when the PSC issued the RockGen CPCN, RockGen did not have all, and certainly most, of the environmental permits that it was required to obtain. The respondents offer some reasons why they believe it's appropriate to ignore the language of the statute, none of which, I believe, have any merit. The PSC suggests that it may issue conditional orders, conditional approvals, because the CPCN doesn't really take effect until after the environmental permits are issued. The problem with that analysis is that imposing conditions doesn't give them the power in the first place to grant the CPCN. The statute specifically requires that the environmental permits predate the issuance of the CPCN. If there are any doubt about the legislature's insistence on that temporal sequence, I think it's removed by the Act 204 amendments to Chapter 196. Prior to Act 204, the DNR had the ability, when it determined which environmental permits were required, to decide which had to be issued before a CPCN could be issued and which had to be issued before construction could commence. So the DNR had some discretion in deciding when the PSC would have its authority to issue a CPCN. Later on in the process, the DNR had the ability, again in consultation with the PSC, to waive a requirement that a specific permit be issued before the CPCN could be issued. The amendments created by Act 204 removed that discretion and put all environmental permits in the pre-CPCN category, meaning that until every one of those permits was actually issued by the DNR, the PSC did not have the authority to issue a CPCN.
Now, where are you specifically referring to?
I believe it's Section 63 of Act 204. Section 63 of Act 204 deleted language which read, "The department shall, in consultation with the commission, also designate which permits and approvals, or portions thereof, must be obtained prior to the issuance of the certificate of public convenience and necessity. Such designation shall be based on findings by the department that the granting or denial of the same could significantly affect overall facility design or location. At any time prior to the issuance of the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, the Department may, in consultation with the Commission, waive the necessity of obtaining any such permit or approval in advance of such certificate." All of that language was deleted.
Does that relate only to Section 96 procedures or to all procedures?
I believe that applies to all procedures under Act 204.
So it applied to all procedures, it applies to 96-2, except where 96 is different.
That's my reading of the statute. I see nothing in the Act which limits its application to Section 96 cases. And I believe that whether or not this court finds that Section 96 was appropriately applied, this CPCN, as issued in this case, is still invalid.
So your argument is, one, it doesn't apply, 96 doesn't apply here. Two, even if 96 did apply, all the bases were not covered.
I don't actually have a position on whether Section 96 applies. Ms. Hedman addressed that argument, and frankly, it's a little too complicated for me with all the electric regulation information involved there. My approach is fairly simple, and it deals with the specific authority of the agency to issue this CPCN, regardless of whether or not it was in an expedited or a non-expedited review.
And you're putting your argument on the basis that the DNR had not issued all the permits. Yet.
That is correct. That is a statutory precondition which was not met.
What about the argument on zoning?
The zoning control issue becomes somewhat complicated. There are two aspects to it. One of them is the impact of this facility, as determined by the PSC, on local land use plans. One of the things that it appears from the record is that the PSC did not even consider the impact of this facility on the Dane County Farmland Preservation Plan. We recognize certainly that electric energy is an important thing. Electric capacity is a significant issue. But the statutes also recognize the importance of farmland preservation. That's one area that the PSC did not even seem to address. The only...
Council, when you say that, finding 14 says that make a finding that the project will not unreasonably interfere with the orderly land use and development plans. So didn't they address it?
They made a conclusory finding, but there was nothing in the record to suggest that they had any information about the Dane County Farmland Preservation Plan. So they did parrot the language of the statute requiring that particular finding, but there's no evidence that they even looked at the Farmland Preservation Plan. In fact, the only evidence that I could find dealing with the impact of this facility on land use planning was testimony by a couple of RockGen employees, I believe they were, who conclusorily stated that this will not have an impact, a negative impact on farmland preservation planning. The important, I should correct that. They didn't say farmland preservation plans. They said the generic land use plans in the area.
What about the Christiana plan, the town's plan?
The town's plan was in the record, and presumably, I have no reason to believe that it was actually looked at by the PSC, but I can't deny that it is in the record, so presumably they had that available as part of their decision.
But the Dane County is not.
The Dane County plan, from what we could tell, was never placed in the record.
But whose obligation was it to make that argument? That argument apparently was not made before the PSC. Is that right?
I don't have any indication that the argument was made. I didn't participate at that stage of these proceedings. I became involved after the decision was made. My view is that it's up to the PSC to support its decision. If it does not have evidence sufficient to support a finding that it makes, that becomes a problem of the order rather than a problem of any of the participants in the process.
Now, are you supportive of the Dane County brief on this issue?
I've reviewed the Dane County brief, and I certainly support the goals of that brief, the farmland preservation goals. I can't say that I concur with all of the conclusions in that brief.
Mr. Reuter, am I correct that the record reflects that the members of the Public Service Commission visited the site, went out to the site for the proposed plant?
I believe there is a reference in the record to the fact that there was a site visit. I don't recall if it's recited in the order, but I believe there was some reference to a site visit.
Am I also correct that nearby this plant, there is an operating quarry understand that there's another plant, another electrical plant close by?
There is a substation nearby, not another electrical generating facility. There is a quarry operating on, I believe it's the adjacent property. Quarries are specifically allowed as conditional uses in the exclusive agricultural zoning ordinances of the county. And there's a significant difference between a building such as an electric generating facility and a quarry. There's a local town chairman in northern Dane County who I think sums it up pretty well. He's in favor of quarries in his town, but he's opposed to residential subdivisions. And his theory is, I can reclaim a quarry, but I can't reclaim a subdivision. And I think that's the real difference. A quarry is a hole in the ground which can be filled in, planted over, and it becomes much like it was the day before the quarry began operation. Once you build a power plant, and this plant is certainly intended to be all but permanent, that's not something that can be easily reclaimed and restore the environment to its pre-construction condition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roddy. You have 2 minutes in rebuttal. We will now hear from Attorney Kevin B. Cronin of representing the Public Service Commission. According to my notes, you have 12 minutes, Mr. Cronin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Cronin. I represent the Public Service Commission. The PSC takes the position in this case that, based on the record, the Commission acted within its authority and properly applied the law in granting to RockGen Energy, LLC, a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, the CPCN, for the construction of an up to 525-megawatt electric generating facility in the town of Christiana in Dane County. The case presents three issues. First, whether Section 96 of Act 204, effective May 12, 1998, applies here. Second, whether the Commission has the authority to condition its CPCN order on obtaining various required DNR environmental permits. Third, whether the conditions the Commission included in the CPCN concerning the size of the plant and the land use are valid. The first issue is whether Section 96 is applicable in this case, and the answer is yes. Section 96 varies the established Section 196, 491, sub 3 CPCN review procedure. By varying this procedure, it does three things. First, it requires that a utility enter into a construction contract by a certain date. Second, it eliminates the requirement to prepare a draft environmental impact statement. And third, the section requires the Commission to take final action on the application within 90 days. And if the Commission fails to take final action within 90 days, the Commission is considered to have issued a certificate with respect to the application. This variation in the standard CPCN review process, it is only for the period May 12, 1998 through August 31st, 1998, and it has no effect thereafter.
That's 1 month.
Three months, June, July, and August.
Right. Okay. Those RFPs would have had to been issued by 5/12, right?
Yes. The pivotal issue to resolve whether Section 96 applies in this case is whether RockGen is a contractor. And Section 96.1B requires, as a condition to invoke Section 96, that an application for a CPCN for a wholesale merchant plant, which is defined as a generating facility that does not sell power at retail and is not owned by a public utility, enter into a contract by July 31, 1998, or a later date approved by the commission. The undisputed facts of record show that, in fact, on July 23, 1998, Alliant reached an agreement with Rockgen, and on July 30, 1998, it informed the commission of their agreement. And these facts alone render Rockgen a contractor under Section 64. Even if Rockgen and Alliant did not reach an agreement by July 31st of 1998, Rockgen is nevertheless a contractor. The reason is the commission approved entering into the construction contract on a later date that it approved under Section 96(1)(b). The commission did so when it issued its August 3rd, 1998 letter approving the contract, and also when the commission concluded in its CPCN order that Rockgen duly applied to the commission for a CPCN.
Council?
Yes.
That deals with the time period. What about the argument of rule that this is really not a contract for the construction of electric generation capacity, that it's really going to supply eastern Wisconsin?
The document is, in fact, the construction contract between Alliant and Rockgen. And
we're in the document, and I have it here. If we're talking about power purchase agreement between Wisconsin Power and Light Company, IES Utilities,
yes,
dated August 10th, where does it say that?
The nature of the agreement itself is the agreement between Alliant and Rockgen for the construction of the plant, and I believe that both Rockgen, when they address this court, can specifically point to the information contained therein that answers the court's question, and Alliant can further support that information.
Okay, so you're expecting Rockgen to tell us where in this purchase agreement it says that they're dealing with eastern Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Council, why was this legislation passed? What was the purpose of it?
The purpose of this legislation was to construct power plants that were needed in the state to meet a identified need that the legislature recognized for an increase in electric generating capacity.
And what was that identified need?
The identified need was for electric generating facilities, and there were three that were on the boards at the time. One was Marinette, an 83 megawatt facility that was constructed. The second was the 300 megawatt facility in Neenah, and the third is the Rockgen facility. Now, the Public Service Commission did not identify the specific location for these plants or their size.
What was the megawatt? You gave us the megawatt for Marinette and Neenah. You didn't give it to us for this one.
This one is approved up to 525 megawatts.
The initial plan at the time that the legislation was passed was for how many megawatts?
There is no language in Section 96 or anywhere in Act 204 that identifies the size of power plants. And significantly, in this legislation, the legislature knew how to write into limitations on the size of megawatts when it included in Section 38 of Act 96.
What was the megawatt in the RFP?
I don't know.
150?
I don't know.
It was less than 525. I don't remember. It was 150 or 170.
There's a difference. One said 170, one said 150. It was either 150 or 170 in the RFP. Is that correct, Council?
Yes. With that in mind, it's important to recognize that in Act 96, there is no limitation whatsoever on the size of the...
But that's in part of your whole argument here. And it's you're saying, look, you look to the language of... the statute, or you look to the language of the Act, and there is no limitation on size. You've got to keep us at the language, because if you get to the legislative intent, you've got some, you may have some problems. So you've got to keep us focused on the language. Is that fair in characterizing your argument?
Yes, it is. And that's exactly the point of Section 96. The language is clear and unambiguous.
Well, what do we do when we get these phrases in the law that says, our job as a court in interpreting the act is to discern the intent of the legislature? What do we do with that body of law?
Well, I think the court has established principles of constructing statutes that are clear on their face, that the court cannot go beyond the plain meaning of the statute. When there are two conflicting statutes, as the Village of Rockdale pointed out between 196, 491, 3E, that says you have to wait for required permits, and Section 96, 1E3, that says the commission shall take final action within 90 days, and if it does not take action, the legislature has said that the CPCN would issue. What we have here is a question of the specific statute controlling over the general. Furthermore, where the purpose of the statute is to build power plants, the court has said that most recently in Baird versus Lee Enterprises, that apparently conflicting provisions of law should be construed to harmonize them and give effect to the leading idea behind the law. And here the leading idea behind this law is to build power plants. No restriction on the size in the statute is imposed. And furthermore, the what has been argued in briefs is that the a state senator has said what the meaning of a statute is. And this court has stated that the opinion of a state legislator is incompetent to derive the meaning of a statute. And furthermore, the opinion of a common of a member of the public, and furthermore, the opinion of a commissioner of the Public Service Commission is incompetent to determine what the meaning of the statute is.
So that's the first issue. The first issue, whether or not, as I see it, is whether or not you stay with the plain language of the statute, or you approach it from saying we want to discern the legislative intent. Maybe you don't take into consideration some of the things that you reference, because our case law says not, but we've got the Legislative Reference Bureau, and there's no argument that the legislative intent was different than what you're arguing. That's the tension of the first argument. Now, the second argument you kind of jumped into in response to my question, and in part that's whether or not there can be conditions on the CPCN, and you started to talk about specific and general. I want to plug into then that second argument. You have, as I understand it, authority for the commission to issue conditional permits, and there's a general statute for that. But then you have the specific statute here, I think it might be 3E 196, that says, as I read it anyway, that they can't authorize CPCN until all the permits have been approved. Is that what that statute says?
Basically, that's correct, Your Honor.
And isn't that a more specific statute? And if you go to the general area of law, specific controls over the general, then you're in trouble. So how do you get around that?
Well, it would be but for one reason. We know what Section 196, 491, 3E says about the DNR required permits. That was created as a part of Act 204. At the same time, the legislature created Act 204 in Section 96.1E3. The legislature said the commission shall take final action on an application within 90 days. And, quote, if it fails to take final action within 90 days, the commission is considered to have issued a certificate with respect to the application.
I
submit that's more specific.
Counsel. Because the PSC could have taken action in 90 days and said no.
Well,
Otherwise, in your argument, the PSC always has to say yes.
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Under Section 196.491.3d, the commission is required to issue a certificate of public convenience and necessity if it determines that all of the requisite criteria for issuing a certificate have been satisfied. And at this point in the process, when the commission was deliberating, it had determined and found that the application met all of the criteria regarding land use, environmental impacts, and so on. And therefore, the commission was required to issue the CPCN, and that was not an option.
What about the requirement that the DNR permits be issued? That's a requirement, too.
If the commission had waited until it received the DNR permits and ignored 96.1E3's direction to issue the certificate, then the certificate would have issued under 96.1E3 without any requirement for the DNR permits.
If your argument is right, then why bother to have anything with the PSC? You just automatically go ahead and do it.
The reason to have this process with the PSC is to do the environmental impact statement under the circumstances to take into account such environmental and other impacts under the required criteria that are necessary for the commission to protect the public interest. Now, in this case, the commission determined in 90 days what it otherwise would have taken 180 days to do for this environmental process, Your Honor.
Is it your position that if the EIS came through okay, the PSC had to issue the certificate?
The EIS, no. The EIS alone is not sufficient. There was extensive technical testimony that Rockdale testified at and never once raised any land use issues.
It seems to me that a logical extension of your argument, to take it to its logical end, is that the size of the plant itself is irrelevant with respect to Section 96, that you can avail yourself, or that this special 90-day procedure can be utilized regardless of whether it's a 100-megawatt plant or a 1,500-megawatt plant. Is that correct?
Yes, and that is what the legislature authorized the applicants seeking a certificate.
Why would you ever... PSC ever utilize the remainder provisions of 204? When would the 180 days ever be used?
The 180 days would be used, Your Honor, in a case when the application is not a qualifying application under Section under Act 204, Section 96. That is an application from a Eastern Wisconsin utility that does not arise out of an RFP that was timely issued, that was not timely filed by the applicant with the commission, and the contract was not timely entered into.
This was special legislation for a three-month period to take care of certain utilities. Is that right?
It was special legislation to take into account the Eastern Wisconsin utilities, Your Honor.
For 3 months. You've gotten to that window, or then you go back to the longer process.
Correct.
It's emergency legislation, theoretically.
Yes.
I still have a problem with this specific in general with regard to the condition. Now, the PSC, this lawful authority for the PSC to condition permits, and that's a general statute. We both agree on that. Then you've got the specific statute in sub E was it 7E or whatever, that says the commission may not issue a certificate, a CPCN, until the department, DNR, has issued all permits and approvals identified in another paragraph that are required. So you've got this specific statute saying, look, you can't issue the CPCN until the PSC knows that the department has made all the approvals, okay? And that sounds to me like good government, you know? Because there's all sorts of things that need to be improved that are referenced in 3A, all sorts of very important things. But then you have this default argument. And the default argument is, if they don't do anything within 90 days, it's approved. And that's kind of with that argument, I have some difficulty with, because if you rely on that argument, it means that the PSC is held to do nothing. The PSC is held not to make sure that the DNR does any studies, issues any approvals, does any permits. All they have to do is go on vacation for 3 months, and then by default it's approved. And I find it hard to comprehend that there should be, that doesn't make sense to me. And therefore I go back to the, look, you've got general, you've got specific, the specific and sub E says you can't issue the CPCN until the DNR has issued the required permits.
My response is 2 points. First, the requirement under 196.491.3E for all required DNR permits is the provision that survives Act Section 96 and Act 204. It is currently in effect today and applies to any application that would require a 180-day review period. Second, the provision under 96.1E3 requiring the commissioner to take final action carries with it the obligation of the commission to protect the public, to go through the process of reviewing the application, conducting public hearings that are required under Section 96, and deliberating those findings before issuing an order. And the legislature told the commission, in effect, to do that process within 90 days, and the commission did. And we believe that the environmental impact statement that we did in 90 days would be the same impact statement under the circumstances that would have been done in 180 days.
That's inconsistent, I think, with your argument. Your other argument is they don't have to do anything within 90 days. And that's in order for this conditional thing to, for you to prevail, you've got to rely on that 90-day pocket provision of 96.
And an intellectual argument is that the commission would not have to do anything within 90 days. However, the fact is that the commission has no overriding obligation to protect the public, and by protecting the public through the requirement in Section 96 to hold hearings, the commission then gathered the evidence, conducted the draft, the environmental impact statement process, received that impact statement, and saw all the information in there about land use, environmental impact, safety, reliability, and all the other required factors that the commission is required to take into account before issuing a CPCN. So,
this 90-day automatic is really no different, as I see it, from 196.491.3G1, which says the same thing about 180 days.
That's correct.
So that's no change.
But there is one change with 180 days that there is now with 90 days. It can be extended by order of the court. There is no provision set for the 90 days for the commission to go to the court for an extension.
But the rule is the same. You don't act within 180 days and you don't get an extension, then it's automatically granted.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Garden, representing Roxanne and Polsky Energy. You're entitled to 10 minutes, counsel, and we ordinarily give attorneys several minutes of free, uninterrupted conversation. I'm not going to do that with you. Where does your contract say that you're going to provide electricity to eastern Wisconsin?
I think I have a number of questions to answer, and I think that's going to be the first one.
Thank you.
There are a number of places in the power purchase agreement that talk about the purchase and sale of electricity. Article 4, page 26. Article 5, page 30.
It says purchase, but why does it say anything? I don't see eastern Wisconsin here.
That's already determined by the fact that Alliant WP&L is an eastern Wisconsin utility, and that definition is statutory, and the basis of that definition is the fact that they are a member of a reliability council.
But they're not required to supply eastern Wisconsin under this contract. They might. They sell outside, don't they?
Alliant does not sell outside. Alliant is required by statute to serve its territory. The purpose of this contract is to provide the capacity and energy for Alliant to serve its territory. In addition to Article 4, Article 5 talks about the actual delivery of power and the circumstances under the delivery of power. Under this contract, Alliant has the right, the first right to all of the power under the contract. It is completely dispatchable by Alliant. That is, Alliant can determine under what circumstances, when to take the power, when not to take the power. They're the ones who can determine that. The contract meets Alliant's reserve margin requirements. It meets their peak load requirements. I think in terms of the initial position of the petitioners, there was confusion about capacity and energy. And I think what I want to be absolutely clear on in taking a look at this contract, it deals with both capacity and energy. Energy delivered to Alliant for Alliant's purpose. Now, if Alliant decides not to take either on the market or under the contract, this energy is most likely to be sold to other eastern Wisconsin utilities. And the reason that that's true is because this plant is sited right by the Rockdale substation. As Your Honor indicated, the commissioners did do a site visit. They looked at that entire site. The Rockdale substation is 1,100 to 1,300 feet from this plant, and the unique nature of the Rockdale substation is this. It provides a direct access to the transmission systems of three Wisconsin utilities, WP&L, Alliant, WEPCO, and MG&E. It does so without the payment. Because of the direct access, there is no payment of a wheeling charge. That's a cost for transmitting electricity over another utility system. And power is needed in eastern Wisconsin. That's been the case since 1997. We have in the record all of the studies that have been done about the need for power. There's that stronger need in eastern Wisconsin than in other places. Council, that's where the power is going to go.
Council, apparently there is information in the record, testimony, something to deal with that Alliant is going to use no more than 8% of the total capacity, and the rest is anticipated that will be sold, and including to customers out of state. Iowa is mentioned. Can you respond to that?
Certainly. I think if that is in the record, I think that there are many other statements in the record provided by the people who are signatories to the contract indicating that this capacity is to be used by Alliant to meet its peak load needs in Wisconsin, that they have the right the first right to power. To the extent that Alliant doesn't take it, might energy be used in that event to go to other utilities, as I was describing? Yes. Might those other utilities potentially sell to another state? They can. but it is not as likely that that would be the case because the power is needed in eastern Wisconsin. But moreover, Act 204 specifically says you can't prevent that because Act 204, the legislature understood that if you're going to solve the electric reliability problem in this state, you must do so on a regional basis. And because of Wisconsin's constrained transmission system, they have an exceedingly great difficulty of importing power from another state. And that's because we have the Great Lakes to the north and to the east. The only place you can get power over a transmission system in Wisconsin is to the west and the south. That's what creates the constrained system. That's the reason you can't rely on transmission paths to get power from other states. You need to build generation in this state. That's the whole premise of Act 204.
Would you agree that the premise of 204 is to take care of the energy needs of Wisconsin?
I think that that is part of Act 204, but it explicitly refers to the fact that the commission, and it recognizes that the commission cannot stop the sale of electricity to other states. So there's a dual purpose. It deals with Wisconsin's needs for the reasons that I've indicated, but also recognizes...
Let's say hypothetically that 92% of the energy generated is sold out of state to help residents of other states and assist them in their energy needs and crisis. Would that be consistent with the intent of this legislation?
I think if you're looking at the legislation and the terms of the legislation itself, I don't think anything prevents that. But I think there's a recognition, again, in terms of how this industry operates, that even in the hypothetical you describe, which I don't think relates to this case, but even in that hypothetical, there is a significant benefit to the state of Wisconsin, because what would occur is if that amount of energy, whatever the 92% relates to, being transmitted out of the state creates the ability, because of the way electrons flow. I know yesterday you talked about Sir Isaac Newton. This is kind of a reference to also Thomas Alva Edison. But the way the electrons flow frees up capacity from another state where the electrons could flow back into Wisconsin. So that even in the hypothetical that you talked about, there is a real benefit to the state of Wisconsin regarding electric reliability because of the freeing up of the transmission system.
Well, Justice Bradley's hypothetical appears at page 20 of Alliance Brief, where Mr. Schutz and the Commission estimate that 8% or less of the energy from the 525 MW plant will be used for normal demand by WPL or other utilities, and the rest may go out of state. And Alliance, as I understand the briefs, and we can discuss it with Alliance, position is that may be true, but that their primary purpose, even though only 8% might be used, their primary purpose was for eastern Wisconsin.
And I believe
and that your position, I gather, is that that's okay under the Act.
I believe it is okay under the Act. I would also say that to the extent you're talking about Mr. Schutz's testimony, I think that there was confusion generated by what Mr. Schutz's testimony said between whether he's going to take under the contract or take in the market. But I don't think there was any confusion ever about Alliant using the power from this project for purposes of eastern Wisconsin. I'd like to turn to another point that was raised previously, and it had to do with this question of the DNR permits. I agree with what Mr. Cronin indicated about the DNR permits. I think another thing that the court should not forget and should be eminently aware of, because it exists throughout the record in this case, the PSC, when it made its decision on the CPCN, had the benefit of the DNR's assessment that the RockGen Energy Center would receive all permits. Specifically, the testimony of DNR at the commission hearing for all DNR permits based on information contained in the applications for these permits and experience with similar facilities in the state, reviewers believed believe that the proposed facilities can be permitted to meet all requirements of law and to protect the resources of the state. But the commission didn't just have that information. They had additional information that there would be no undue adverse impacts to air quality. In fact, the testimony is that the allowable emissions here are less than 1% of the national ambient air quality standards. And moreover, the commission knew that the DNR had concluded that there would be no adverse impacts on water quality. So all of those things were known by the commission because of the extensive investigation that they had undertaken prior to the determination they made with respect to the order that was issued.
Summary sentence now that you read lights on.
The summary sentence is, I think, that the record in this case demonstrates that the commission went through and the DNR went through an exhaustive analysis of all of the factors under the 196-491, that their determination is correct and that that determination should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garden. Mr. Sturgeon, representing Alliant Energy.
May it please the court, my name is Richie Sturgeon, and I represent Alliant Energy, Wisconsin Power and Light Company, and I will add two brief points to the comments made by my colleagues representing the commission and RIPGEN. First of all, petitioner rule argues that the 90-day CPCN review process should not apply in this case because the purchase power agreement for the 525 megawatt plant is not a contract because it allegedly doesn't benefit Wisconsin. First of all, petitioner rule cannot dispute the fact that all of the elements of an enforceable contract exist in a purchase power agreement: offer, acceptance, and consideration. RIPGEN offered the capacity to Wisconsin Power and Light Company. Wisconsin Power and Light Company accepted the capacity at an agreed-to price, the consideration being the exchange of capacity for compensation. And although not relevant to the issue of whether or not the purchase power agreement is a contract, the purchase power agreement clearly benefits Wisconsin. All Wisconsin utilities, including Wisconsin Power and Light Company, must have reserve margin of electric capacity. In other words, they must have more electricity than is being used by consumers on any given day to prevent situations like we see in other parts of the country where you have very hot summers and then there's a blackout or a threat of a blackout or power failure due to tornadoes. It's kind of like car insurance. You may not use your car insurance proceeds on a daily basis, but car insurance is valuable, necessary, and legally required for unforeseen circumstances such as an accident. It's like a savings account. You do not dip into your savings account on a daily basis. You dip into your checking account because the savings account is to deal with unforeseen circumstances. And that's what Mr. Schutz was testifying to. We did not purchase this capacity to meet our daily normal needs. We purchased this capacity for our reserve margins, which is actually, there's a difference between capacity and energy. Energy talks about using electricity for your daily normal use. Capacity talks about having this capacity saved out here just in case there's a problem with blackouts or brownouts or tornadoes causing power failures. And clearly this 525 megawatt plant meets WPNL's capacity needs.
Well, Mr. Sturgeon, suppose you were going to build a plant that was going to meet the emergency needs of eastern Wisconsin.
Yes.
What would the megawatt be?
That was described in our Advanced Plan 8. If you look at our Advanced Plan 8.
What is it? What's the magic number?
According to our advanced plan, which is what we use to forecast our electric capacity, it shows that WPL needed 282 megawatts of electric capacity by 2001, 423 megawatts by 2002, and 705 by 2003. Now,
What about Advanced Plan 7?
Advanced Plan 7, which was filed January 94, 4 years prior to Advanced Plan 8, which was filed in January 98, showed that the 170 megawatts probably would have been okay. But before the CPCN, which is that issue in this case, was ordered, we had Advanced Plan 8, which shows that Advanced Plan 7, decided 4 years earlier, was obsolete. Advanced Plan A shows that the 170 megawatts is insufficient. As a matter of fact, the 525 megawatts will become insufficient within a couple years. We will need to go through this process again and get capacity to meet our 705 megawatt capacity needs by 2003.
Where are you going to build the next one?
A lot of that deals with a lot of studies, engineering studies, cost effectiveness. It also goes to the same things that the commission looked at in this case, the environment, the land use. All of that has to be considered. It's not an easy thing where I can just
can
sit
you
here
increase
and make
this? Can you increase this plant?
Pardon?
Can you increase, expand this plant to provide 705?
No, it's approved for 525 megawatts, and that is as high as it can go. And I'm not aware of any capability for it to go higher than 525 from an engineering point of view.
Well, what numbers, if any, did the legislature consider? I mean, now they're making an emergency ruling for 3 months, really, to accommodate a limited number of utilities, right? How
correct.
Many?
Correct.
Just you? Just Alliant and Rockton?
And then two other Eastern utilities.
Okay.
Correct. The legislator did not put a number in the statute. The genesis of this whole case is there was an energy crisis. Energy crisis that have existed since 1997 and still exists today because we still don't have the proper capacity. At that point in time, as the justice indicated, there was an Advanced Plan 7 that was in play when the energy crisis existed in 97. The legislator, the governor's office, the commissioners, the DNR, and members of the public are concerned with resolving the energy crisis. The utilities, looking into it in 1998, 4 years from 1994, said, look, our capacity needs have changed. The population of the state has grown. Our reserve margins went from 15% to 18%. In order for us to make sure that we provide reliable utility service in this state, prevent blackouts, prevent brownouts, to deal with situations that you see California dealing with now.
Let's get back to the question of the number. In Assembly Bill 940, at the time that it was introduced, Legislative Reference Bureau had an analysis. It made reference in its analysis under the heading Electric Generating Capacity to the request for proposals, the RFPs.
Yes.
The RFPs here were based on Advanced Plan 7. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the RFPs then contained the number that was in Advanced Plan 7, that being 170 megawatts?
Yes.
Okay. So at the time that the bill was introduced, according to the Legislative Reference Bureau, under electric generating capacity, it said, and the bill shortens the regulatory approval deadlines that would otherwise apply to the, meaning that additional capacity. The capacity is referenced as the capacity in the request for proposals. Is it your, can you disagree that the electric generating capacity referred to in the RFP was 170 megawatts. Let me rephrase it. You agree that the 170 megawatts is the capacity that's referred to in the RFP that's set forth in the Legislative Reference Bureau analysis. Is that correct?
Yes, I agree that that was the number before the legislators at that time. However, the crux of it is not 170, 230, 530. The crux of it is an energy crisis. How do the utilities, the commission, and the legislator and the governor go about resolving the utility?
So at the time this bill is passed, you agree that the number that the legislature had that was set forth at the RFP that was before them was 170 megawatts. Is that correct?
I agree that it's in the legislative history, but I disagree that it's in the statute.
Well, I agree.
Okay.
My question is, you agree that the number that the legislature had before them at the time that this legislation passed was an RFP for 170 megawatts. Is that correct?
Yes, I don't disagree with that.
Well,
sorry.
It was a fiscal estimate, so you agree with that it was 100. There was a fiscal estimate, and I think it's dated 4/7/98, it says they had, and I'm not sure if it applies to this or not, but it seems to, a similar shortened process is established for 500 MW of capacity, currently under bid by the Wisconsin Utilities, with a 45-day time limit for permit issuance.
Correct, which was based upon our advanced plan 8, which was subsequent to the to the beginning of when this started taking place. And as a matter of fact, 170/525 is, in a true sense, it makes no difference. The analysis for 170 megawatt plant is the same analysis for the 525 megawatt
plant. This note then with the reference to the 500 megawatts, though, was the 500 megawatts that was the total amount to be divided between the three different utilities and the this utility getting 170. Is that?
No. 525.
How about the 500 that's referenced in the fiscal note then? Isn't that?
We're the ones who need the 525, Wisconsin Power and Light Company.
No, that's not my question. My question is, what does the 500 in the fiscal note refer
to? I would assume, I did not look at it in detail, but I would assume it would apply to our needs since we're the ones who asked for it pursuant to this contract.
Well, it says it refers to utilities then under bid.
And as far as I know, we're the only utility that was under bid at that time.
Weren't there three utilities that the capacity determined by the study was an increase of 500 megawatts? And so you had the three utilities and you divided 500 in some kind of not equal proportions, and the amount allotted to operation was 170 out of that 500. Is that your understanding of the history of this matter?
No, that is not my understanding. Otherwise, you would have to include the advanced plan 8 of the other two utilities, not just our advanced plan. The 525 was what we asked for. Just a brief, last brief point. I believe that this court should affirm the commission's decision pursuant to public policy. This court stated in Union Co-op at 206 Wisconsin 160 that the dominant purpose of utility law is to secure and ensure adequate service on the part of public utilities at reasonable rates. And in the view of accomplishing that purpose, the regulation of utilities have been committed to the Public Service Commission. And this court goes on to state that that delegation of authority is broad. And then in the Calamont case at 148 Wisconsin 334, this court stated that it does not like technical assaults against public utility laws. In this situation, you do not hear the petitioners arguing that scientific study shows that this 525 megawatt plant unreasonably interferes with the land use. This 525 megawatt plant is not needed in Wisconsin. What you hear the petitioner saying is that the 525 megawatt plant is not, pursuant to the purchase power agreement, is not really a contract. I dealt with that. They also state that the 90-day CPCN review process should only apply to the 170 megawatt plant, not the 525. That doesn't make sense. The analysis is the same for 170 and 525. You look at cost effectiveness. You look at the impact on the environment. And the commission and DNR did more than the thorough job in looking at the land use issue. They looked at such evidence as geology, soils, floodplains, vegetation, wildlife, wetlands, threatened and endangered species, local government services, shared revenue payments, railroads, roads, recreation areas. They looked at the whole gamut. It was replete. They have a 170-page EIS statement that's replete with evidence showing that there is no unreasonable interference with land use. And Wisconsin Power and Light Company needs the capacity. It will not meet all of its capacity needs. We're going to have to go through this very soon. Certainly the 170 is insufficient. It was insufficient as of January 1998, and we believe that the commission and DNR's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Frank Remington, Assistant Attorney General representing the DNR.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Frank Remington. I am an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here today in representation of the Department of Natural Resources. I gave myself 3 minutes because I think the issues involving the DNR are very simple. At least I hope you think that as well. There are two complaints, as I understand the appellants in this case, regarding the DNR. One, that there was not enough time for the public interest groups to respond to the EIS that was put out for public comment. And secondly, that the EIS was not released preliminarily as a draft. My first task, I believe, is to impart to the court a clear understanding of the rules that govern the Department of Natural Resources. I'm here to tell you that the DNR staff complied with all rules and regulations that were incumbent upon them, that applied to them in this case. If you assume that Section 96 applied, if you assume that Section 96 applied, DNR staff did the processing of the environmental impact statement exactly how their rules provide. Ordinarily, it's a 45 to 90 day process. Section 96 reduces that down. DNR rules explicitly provide that the DNR agency must change their processing in accordance with their colleague agency, which is what they did. If you assume it applies, there is no error in process to be alleged against the natural resources. Secondarily, the draft issue. I think the draft issue is actually a non-issue for the Department of Natural Resources. The Public Service Commission has rules that require it, in the ordinary case, to release the EIS for comment as a draft, receive those comments, change the document if they determine it appropriate, and then release the final EIS, a two-part process. The Section 96 changes that in this case and relieved the Public Service Commission of that requirement that was incumbent upon it. The Department of Natural Resources never had that rule, whether we're talking about Section 96 cases or otherwise. The Department of Natural Resources releases the environmental impact statement for public comment, receives those comments, determines if it should be changed, changes them or not changes them, and then releases it. There is no obligation in the Department of Natural Resources administrative rules to release documents as drafts for a two-step public comment purpose. So the comments of the petitioners, the appellants in this case, certainly are not germane to the operation of the process in the Department of Natural Resources. Finally, the question of remedy. What is the remedy? Well, there's been some discussion about the DNR permits. I'm here to tell you that I think the record indicates that the DNR did issue all the necessary and requisite permits. So in terms of the court's task under Section 227-57, I think sub 4 says that in cases of alleged irregularity of procedure, the court looks for material error. The issue of the comment on the environmental impact statement, the court should again look for material error. The Department of Natural Resources believe it conducted a thorough and comprehensive review of the environmental impacts. That the court is aware in the numerous cases in which it's looked at environmental impact statements, that it's an information gathering, a document that produces information for subsequent decisions. That document was prepared. It was prepared and issued in less time than was normally accorded, but it was done in a thorough, competent, and professional manner. There has been no allegation other than time for time's sake that there was any document that was not submitted because of the reduced amount of time. There was no argument that was not made because of the truncated alleged procedure. It simply was a claim by the appellants in this case that it needed more time. No allegation of material error has been made in this case, and I believe under the statute, the scope of review that this court employs, one could conclude that even if there was an error in this procedure, it does not necessarily require a reversal and remand to the agency for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Remington. That concludes the respondents. We are now to rebuttal. Ms. Hedman.
Contrary to respondent's assertions, this is one of those situations where, to put it bluntly, size matters. It matters in at least two respects. It matters because the RFP that was discussed in Section 96 clearly referred to the RFPs that had been issued and were pending at the time of that legislation. And Wisconsin Power and Light's RFP was for 150 megawatts.
Let's get with those numbers. Your opposing counsel didn't apparently agree with me, but I understand that the commission determined that there was an unmet need for 500 megawatts, consistent with the fiscal note that the chief referred to. And on March 10th, 1998, the commission then indicated that of the 500, they divvy it up this way. 250 went to WEPCO, 100, I think, went to maybe MG&E, 170 went to Alliant, that's 520, but then when the RFP goes out, and when on October 15th, 1998, the commission issued its notice of proceeding, it made reference to 150 for Rock Gem Energy and Alliant, which gets the 500 number, which is the basis of the fiscal note. Is that your understanding of the proceeding?
That is exactly my understanding of what happened, and that number, somewhere in the range of 150 to 170 megawatts, is what the legislature must have understood to be in the RFP.
Then why didn't the legislature put it into the legislation?
I can't answer that. I suppose if I could speculate, it was so clear to the legislature which RFPs they were talking about that they didn't think there would be any question. The RFPs, that suggests a very high degree of detailed knowledge on the part of the legislature about what was going on.
But Advanced Plan 8 was already before them, right?
Advanced Plan 8 is irrelevant to this proceeding. When this CPCN was issued, Advanced Plan 8 was a proceeding just in its infancy. The estimates for capacity needs that are referenced in Alliance briefs about Advanced Plan 8 were Alliance estimates of what it might need. They were not the Public Service Commission's determinations of what was needed, and they were certainly not in the record as a determination of need that the legislature would have been aware of or that the Public Service Commission might have used in the RockGen proceeding. If I could just make one more point, Alliant is not a public utility with an obligation to serve customers in Wisconsin. Alliant is a registered multi-state holding company. Wisconsin Power and Light, an Alliant subsidiary and an affiliate, is the utility with an obligation to serve. And that is why this contract is so important. Alliant is not mentioned in this contract. This is a contract that involves Wisconsin Power and Light and two other utilities that aren't even in Wisconsin. And it's important to keep that in mind, I think, because as we've talked about this, we've made a lot of references to Alliant and Alliant system. And Alliant system is not just a system in eastern Wisconsin.
Can I ask you a question? Do you know how long Assembly Bill 940 was in drafting?
I couldn't speak to that. I can tell you that Assembly Bill 940 became... I can't answer that with specificity. I shouldn't speculate.
Do you have the copies of the drafting instructions?
I think I only have the language here. I don't think I have the drafting instructions with me in court.
It was in March of 98. that, wasn't it drafted within March of 98?
Council, tab 9 of the appendix, does that have the history?
I'm just checking. Yes, I do have it. I do have it.
What date should one associate with Advanced Plan 8?
Advanced Plan 8 commenced in 1999. The Advanced Plan 8 order was issued in 1999. Up until that time, all of the utilities had submitted estimates of what they thought their capacity needs might be, but the commission had not made any sort of determination regarding what was actually needed in Advanced Plan 8 until 1999. I can't give you the exact date. The CPCN in this case was issued in December of 1998, and the only relevant identified capacity needs that the Public Service Commission had identified at that point were those in Advanced Plan 7 and those that had been specifically authorized in the letter orders to the utilities directing them to issue the RFPs, one of which was the Wisconsin Power and Light RFP for 150 megawatts.
Would it be fair to say that the genesis of this bill dates back to 1997 or perhaps even before?
Certainly there had been legislative studies of deregulation in Wisconsin, if we're talking about Act 240 generally, that go back to that period of time, absolutely.
According to your appendix, it was introduced in March 98. And according to my notes on instructions, it was in March of 98. Could it all have been done in March?
It looks like a busy month.
Okay, we can check that. Well, and then on 145, we've got the legislative history through the journal, I think you'd say. It was introduced in March 1998 and published April 30th.
If you have the drafting instructions, Chief, when the request was submitted to the Legislative Reference Bureau, was there a draft with it or simply a request?
Instructions. Labeled Governor Thompson's reliability proposal. So I don't know. That's what I have. We can check that out. Thank you. Mr. Reuter.
I have just three quick points that I'd like to make arising out of the comments made by opposing counsel. The first comment has to do with the suggestion by Rockgen's counsel that the PSC had before it information that the reviewers of the permits believed that it was likely the permits would be issued. I don't think there's any question that that falls well short of the standard of permits in hand as the statute requires. Secondly, counsel for the DNR has now suggested that all of the environmental permits have been issued and therefore you should find harmless error. A couple quick responses to that. First of all, there's nothing in the record to suggest that that is the case. The permits were not in the PSC record, and that was the whole argument that we made. Secondly, I have no reason to doubt the credibility of counsel, there has been a previous assertion by Rockgen's counsel in this case in an attempt to introduce documents that were claimed to be the permits that were required. Those were the subject of a motion to strike from the record, which we had filed and were successful on. As part of that process, we demonstrated through DNR information that, in fact, those were not permits that had been issued to Rockgen as they had been claimed. The last issue that I want to address is the question of the PSC's argument that it had no choice but to issue the CPCN because of the terms of Section 196.491.3D. That section does mandate the issuance of the CPCN if all the required conditions are met. However, Act 204 made an amendment to that provision by adding an exception for the terms of Paragraph E. Paragraph E is the provision which requires that all permits be in hand before a CPCN can be issued. That section now reads, except as provided in Paragraph E and Section 196.493, the Commission shall approve an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity only if the Commission determines all of the following. So the amendment specifically negates the argument that sub D overrules sub E, and in fact it makes it the other way around. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. That concludes our hearing on 99-24.